but you don't know what you got till it's gone. You'd be in paradise and put up a fucking lie. Welcome to At the Table. I'm Clark Wolf, and this is the weekly radio show about all things food, brought to you from Sonoma County. Not just wine country, but farm country, and it turns out, chocolate country. Now, mind you, we're not growing the plants. Although I did see a coffee plant, a coffee tree, not long ago. Mind you, it was struggling a little bit. And with climate change, who knows? You know, in the middle of Santa Rosa, we might have a rainforest. Who knows what's going to happen? But in the meantime, chocolate here is something that is made by people who really care about it, who really know about it. And it's been a couple of years since I had these folks in. And I thought it was a time that we should go back to talking about chocolate because people love it. And also because the cost has gone way up. There have been chocolate scandals. Oh my gosh. Call the Inquirer. Does that still exist? Probably not. Anyway, my guests today are Susan and Jeff Mall, and they have the wonderful, beloved, and very popular Volo Chocolate. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Clark.
Thanks so much, Clark.
Great to see you again.
Good to see you.
Yeah, and it's always good this time of the year because, I mean, of course, chocolate season mirrors cheese season in a lot of ways because it starts kind of in October. It's like it's getting cooler. Ooh, I want a dessert. I want a chocolate cake. And then Thanksgiving and then Christmas. But it's February where it really launches, right? It's Valentine's Day and then Mother's Day and Easter. I remember visiting with James Beard a place called Lilac Chocolate in Greenwich Village. They produced and sent millions of dollars worth of chocolates to the Vatican every Easter. Yeah, it was a business. Wow. What can I tell you? But so I want to talk about chocolate. I want to talk about your style of chocolate. I want to talk about the haven of craft in Windsor.
In Windsor.
Of all places.
In an industrial park that is doing what the Barlow kind of pretends to be riffing off of. Is that fair?
Yeah. It's a great blend of businesses, great neighbors that we have, artisan producers, brewery. There's now going to be...
Gluten-free bakery
and a sake company is coming.
I mean, come on. All right. Yeah.
And then
all right. So, Susan, you start. First of all, tell us the kind of the story of how you guys went from doing Zin and other wonderful restaurant and cooking things to being masters of chocolate.
Well, we were offered the opportunity to go down to Baja California South, to the Todos Santos area, Pescadero in particular, to be the co-executive chefs of a little boutique hotel where we had previously consulted for 5 years. And we jumped at the chance. Why not? We didn't have the restaurant. But while we were there, we got a little bored after we'd developed some recipes. And Jeff noticed a jar of cocoa beans up on the shelf left over from the previous chef and said, "Oh, honey, I wonder how hard it is to make chocolate." And I thought, oh, God, what are we getting ourselves into?
who left the chef in the kitchen?
Exactly.
But isn't that really how things work?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So.
How did you start cooking in life?
I started working in restaurants actually before I was even in high school, bussing tables. My friend's dad was a manager at a local restaurant, and they needed some help on like a holiday weekend. And I wasn't even, you know, maybe 13 or something. And they just said, pour water and take, you know, dirty plates away. And I was hooked, you know?
Yeah. For me, I was in Van Nuys, California, and it was at Hunter's Cafeteria. I remember being on a very tall ladder, wiping dust off the top of plastic chandeliers at the age of 16, right?
And thinking, God, I love this business.
Exactly. And there was a gal behind the counter that used to call me hun.
It was
perfect. Right?
And how about you, Susan? How did you get involved?
I started cooking at 4 when my family wouldn't get up in time to make pancakes for me. My dad taught me how to make them, and they wouldn't get up early enough to eat, so I'd go to the neighbor's house and start cooking breakfast for them so that they could get to church on time. And from there, food has always been a part of my life.
All right, so Jeff, and how did you get involved as a professional? So this is early on.
That's early on. So once I got the restaurant bug, and I just wanted to keep working in restaurants because a very key thing at that time, bussing tables, the servers give you tips at the end of it. So I was walking home.
Yeah, I heard about
this. I was walking home with cash in my pocket every day, every night. So that's just kind of what got it. And eventually I went to a restaurant in high school and I told the chef that I wanted to be a chef. I loved cooking. And so I transferred from the floor and started learning in the kitchen, you know, at the bottom of the totem pole, doing vegetable prep and things like that, and worked my way up. And then, you know, I went to college and went to University of San Francisco, went into the hotel and restaurant program there.
Excellent.
And then after that, went to the CIA in Hyde Park, New York.
Wow. So you really did. You started clearing dishes and you ended up at the Culinary Institute in Hyde Park.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's how that's supposed to be. And Susan, after the age of four and newly instituted child labor laws.
Yes. So I was also doing things like running bake sales in junior high and high school. And my mother told me at one point when I was 18, you better come up with what you want to do.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, I love food. I'll go into nutrition. And oh, boy, that was not fun. it was like there's nothing exciting about this. And I was actually talking with somebody one day later, maybe 2-3 years later, and they said, if you could do anything in the world without even thinking about it, what would you do? I said, I'd go to culinary school.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I thought, well, there you go. And I bought in the bookstore at school, I bought La Technique by Jacques Pepin.
Oh, my God.
And started studying that and ignored my regular studies.
Well, of course, that's how these things are done. By the way, if you've just joined us, the people happily talking about cooking and food are Susan and Jeff Mall from Volo Chocolate. So did you go to culinary school?
I ended up, yeah.
Where?
I went to California Culinary Academy.
I remember those guys.
Yep. And before that, I kind of did the backwards thing of what Jeff did. You did go to business. You took the business courses. I took business courses as well before I went to culinary school.
You know, it's so funny. So I was in college at San Francisco State University, and the last thing I did there was to cater the English department Christmas party for 165 English faculty, just because I could. I covered stacks of senior theses, right, with aluminum foil, and made these constructs, you know what I mean, and plants, and I had little Shakespearean quotes, and I couldn't figure out one for the cheese and cracker table, so I wrote "Methinks thou art crackers," you know, stuff like that. Yeah. And it was a kind of astounding situation where I fed S.I. Hayakawa.
Oh my gosh.
And here's the thing. So at my bar mitzvah, there was a chopped liver Jewish star about 5 inches thick with my name written on it in egg yolk, right?
Wow.
Like whipped egg, right? Yellow, okay? So my friend, though, who is a professor, wanted to bring me one because it was kind of my going away from college, too. And she brought one. It was an inch tall. And there was a note that said, this stuff is expensive. But I ended up getting a job in a cheese and wine shop because there was a sign in the window in San Francisco. And I applied to be the manager. They went Chapter 11 the second week. I got my MBA the hard way. You know what I mean? And I ran that for 2.5 years.
Wow.
Before it could be sold. So exactly. And then it went on to, you know, run the Oakville Grocery and all that. So it's really amazing how you start dusting and clearing dishes and you end up in another place. So you got the cocoa beans. Let's get back to that.
Yeah.
And you what did you do with cocoa beans in a jar?
Well, so I looked up, like, how do you make chocolate? And so, you know, one of the things that finding a website about making chocolate says the first thing you need is to have the cacao or the cocoa beans. The second thing you need to have is this very specialized stone grinder to process them into chocolate. And I looked at it and I said, oh, that's the exact same stone grinder that we brought with us to Mexico in order to make corn tortillas from our own corn.
Tortillas.
So I already had that. So I like already got the grinder. We got the cacao.
I knew that chocolate and tortillas had something to do with it.
Yeah. So anyway, I just started experimenting, roasting them in a wood oven, you know, trying things out. And you know, some of our staff came from parts of Mexico that had more chocolate making traditions than Baja. And we just did trial and error, and we got lucky on the first time. Tasted okay, not bad, not good.
Yeah, and, you know, excuse me, but it reminds me of cheesemakers. In the early years, they say the pigs ate a lot of cheese. Yeah. Right? If you, yeah. if you try that and you say, here, have this for lunch. No, yeah. but it gets better.
Yeah, and so we just kept with it. And before you know it, we were... hotel guests were coming into the restaurant as we were roasting the cacao in the oven, you know, wood-fired oven. Cacao smells, roasting smells like brownies. And then we would be hand peeling the beans in the kitchen. And the guests would say, what are they doing? I say, well, we're roasting cacao to make chocolate and we're hand peeling the beans. And they would say, wow, can we try that? And so we'd hand them a big pile of beans and we have this free labor.
Heaven.
So we're talking free labor.
Yeah, free labor our guests.
Exactly.
And then 2 days later, we would sell them the bars that we made from those beans.
So we're calling that immersive experience.
Yes, yes. Immersive experience.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So that's now illegal in 5 states. Susan, what were you doing while he was starting a whole new world in the middle of the kitchen?
I was helping peel cacao. I was right there with him. I also documented a lot of it. I've got pictures of the very first batch that we slipped into the wood-burning pizza oven. And
that. Yeah, I mean, what we have to remember, folks, is wood-burning oven is the term. It's not necessarily a pizza oven. You can roast a chicken in that oven. Yeah. You can roast vegetables. Apparently, you can roast cacao.
Yeah.
You can roast, you know, all kinds of things. And that's why it's so important to be able to understand how a particular cooking process works and then realize that if you're dealing with nature, this works like that, works like that. It's one of those things where when I learned about food, I learned about learning about food. And you get a sense of those things, even if you don't have a technical training. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk about Volo and how it's a very special kind of chocolate in a Mexican tradition with very Northern California qualities. Right back here at the table. We are back at the table. I'm Clark Wolf, and I'm here with the Moll family, Jeff and Susan Moll, and they have Volo chocolate. So somebody jump in and tell us how you came to this style of chocolate making and how you describe it.
Well, we were in Mexico, and so we wanted to be, you know, make something that was what we thought would be more authentic to where we were. And so,
and to honor the tradition of Mexican chocolate making,
which one of the first ingredients or one of the hallmarks of that is a little bit of cinnamon,
just
a touch,
just enough, and it makes it completely. I don't want to say it's a different quality, but it really is. It's almost like it's almost like a sound that you don't necessarily hear, but you feel.
I say that it rounds out the base note of chocolate.
Yeah.
That it completes it so that you get even more of a pronounced flavor of chocolate with just that little bit of cinnamon.
Well, also, I want to say this very clear to people. California has always liked single varietal kind of stuff. But the history of chocolate is blending, like olive oil is blending, like coffee is blending, right? And this conceit that a single tree is going to make, I mean, we do this together.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, right when we were doing this, bean to bar chocolate making was just kind of coming into it, you know, as a chocolate business was happening in the U.S. And what that was, it meant that there were, instead of just having chocolate from massive, you know, producers, you had people that really, much like winemakers, who cared about the origin of the cacao, recognized the unique flavor profiles of terroir, essentially of where it was grown, what that contributes. So you were developing fine flavor chocolate. And so we wanted to be a part of that, and we truly went into that to showcase the flavors. And in Mexico, it was cacao from Chiapas, Mexico. It was not local to where we were, but it was local to southern Mexico.
Well, let's remember that local is a relative term.
Right? Absolutely.
I mean, we grow everything here in Sonoma County, but not everything here in Sonoma County, right?
Yeah.
And Alice Waters and Chez Panisse always said, if I can get it there in a day in a truck, properly done and thoughtfully, you know, raised and harvested, then it's okay. Then it's local. I mean, let's not be slavish about that, right? That's crazy. Now, but when you get the fruit, There is a fermentation process.
Yes. So that happens at harvest, at origin. So, you know, much like the wine industry, they harvest the fruit of the cacao tree. When the Brix hits the right number, measuring the sugar,
right.
They crack open this fruit. They scoop out the seed pod, which are these giant white seeds that look like kind of gooey hominy. And they go into basically a fermentation box, much like you have here. And between the heat of the jungle where it's grown, because this grows in a very hot, you know, jungly area, the natural sugars in the cacao fruit and the wild yeast, it goes through a fermentation process. And that fermentation process is what develops the chocolate flavor.
And there's the seed in the center, and right. then the fermenting all around it in that fruit, that goes away and they clean it away.
Well, so some parts of Mexico do clean that away, and that's a different kind of chocolate.
Different style.
But we want is that fully fermented, because if it's not fermented right, it will be very bitter.
All right, but again, so after the fermentation is done, what's the status of that white goo?
Oh, so then it dries. They spread out, so that kind of adheres to the bean.
Got it.
And it's dried in the sun, basically.
And the white beans, within a couple days, start going through a coloring process. They become kind of light brown, then purple, then deeper color.
Oh, my gosh.
And by the time they are ready to be dried, which is 6 to 7 days of the fermentation, then they have turned brown, and they are dry.
Now, some people are using other parts of the fruit to make food.
Yes, they are. They're using the cacao pulp and a juice. The thing is that, you know, there's not a infrastructure set up to really capitalize on that, because mostly where cacao is grown is on these, you know, crazy
rural,
in the middle of nowhere, in the jungle, no electricity, no, and the cacao fruit, to use it, needs refrigeration and all that. So.
And so that's outside of that white thing.
Yeah, so the fruit of the cacao pod is very sweet.
Yeah.
It's like a...
So I'm seeing this. It looks like a papaya on steroids.
Yes.
And it's related to a papaya.
There you go. Okay. And so there's the outside. There's the skin. Mm-hmm. Then there's the flesh. Mm-hmm. And then there are these white pods, almost like pomegranate has arils, where the seed is inside and it's wrapped with this red thing that when you squeeze it and bite on it, it stains your shirt forever.
Yeah.
The thing is, when you crack open a cacao pod, it looks like there's an ear of corn standing up in it.
Yeah, it really does.
Yeah,
right. All right, if you've just joined us, that ear of corn is actually chocolate, and it becomes Volo, right?
Yeah.
So what was the first, eureka moment when you started working on this stuff, and you're doing it, and some of the first stuff was okay, but not, you know, what was the point when it went, bingo, hey, we've got this?
Well, I liken it to we made the first batch by just kind of following our intuition, and then said, well, let's see what the forums do and what they suggest. And that was starting it off at the beans in a slow temperature in a oven and stirring it every 5 minutes and checking the temperature as the rate of the heat went up in the beans. And we followed it to a tea, made the chocolate, and it was awful. So I said, must not have done this right. Did it again. And once again, it was like nothing in comparison to what we had. And I looked at Jeff and I said, we're chefs. We understand how to coax flavors from food.
Right.
We know what we're doing. We need to rely upon our own instincts. And let's just go from here.
I love that you turned off your YouTube channel.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, because I do know that farmers learn all about farming from YouTube and all kinds of chefs learn all kinds of things. But you're right. I think that's such an important thing for you to be saying, that if you really love cooking, if you really care about it, and again, you don't have to be hyper trained to get a feel for it. And as you said, you were making pancakes at 4, right? I wasn't very old before I knew that my mother, who was very talented in many ways, could not cook. Bless her heart.
Yeah.
You know, she was a concert pianist. She raised roses. She made incredible beaded and embroidered clothing, and she overcooked everything else.
Oh,
yeah, it was not wonderful. All right. So when did what happened? Now? When did it become a business?
So we stayed in Mexico, working and living there for a year and a half, and that was kind of the end of our agreement to be down there. And we came back to home in Healdsburg and said, wonder what we're going to do next. And we made some, we brought some, our equipment home, and we had ordered some cacao online. Said, let's just try making a batch of chocolate for fun. We did. We made a home batch. We happened to then go to a got invited to a party at a friend's house. It was all chefs and other food writers and food people. And then one of the bars ended up on the desk of Heather Irwin at the Press Democrat.
Uh-oh.
And unbeknownst to us, then she wrote an article saying Jeff and Susan are home from Mexico and they're starting a chocolate company.
Well, there you go.
At which point we said,
I guess we are starting
yeah. a chocolate company.
And most of your initial selling has been at farmers market.
In the very beginning, it was farmers markets, but we realized that in order to survive, we had to do more volume and add in wholesale accounts to get to make it a viable business. And you know, the hard thing about selling our farmers markets here are mainly in the summertime. Selling chocolate at a farmers market in the summertime is
not the best idea.
People are like walking around, it's 95 degrees in the shade, and they're like, why would I want to buy chocolate?
So, well, what you do is you just hold it up and watch it melt.
Yeah. Right? Well, I say, as it's melting, that's the best time to taste it, just before it melts. It's just, you know, all the flavors come out of it.
I have a feeling there's a lot of people with chocolate on their chin, but now you can get it all over the place. And the wonderful thing about Sonoma County is that we have some of the most, and the most, grocery stores. I've never been anywhere where there were this many groceries, and they're all successful because people love food and they care about it. And we spend money on food and wine the way other communities spend on healthcare. I mean, we are really much more European in that respect, right? Mm-hmm. We, as a percentage of our lives, we want to have a great piece of fruit, a wonderful pizza, a delicious bar of chocolate. And when we get back, we are going to talk about your specific delicious chocolates because you make a bunch of them. We'll be right back here at the table. We are back at the table. I'm Clark Wolf, and I'm here with Susan and Jeff Mall, and they have Volo Chocolate. In the last year or two, the cost of chocolate and everything associated with it has multiplied like crazy.
It's beyond multiplying.
Yeah, it's some of it's climate change and some drought, right? And some of it's international relations. Give us a word or two about that.
I mean, it's mainly driven by climate change, you know, global warming. That's what's caused, like, the weather that we have now with getting, instead of just regular rain, we have, you know, atmospheric rivers. Parts of the world have droughts. They have the same type of thing. So that those drastic weather events have truly decimated cacao crops. And as a result, the world supply of chocolate was 2 years ago, was just decimated.
It was down by 40% worldwide.
All right. And the thing about it is this. In the 10 years before, they started putting chocolate into everything because somebody realized in marketing, ooh, if we add chocolate. I mean, I sometimes have chocolate very carefully and on purpose.
Yeah.
But if I go to the ice cream case, and 90% of the flavors have chocolate in them, I get really angry. Just give me coffee ice cream. Give me vanilla or give me chocolate or give me double fudge with hoo-hoo, whatever the heck.
Yeah.
But, I mean, toothpaste. You know what I mean? There's chocolate in everything and it's too much.
Protein bars.
Yeah.
I try to look for protein bars that don't have chocolate.
Me too. Me too. Because I want them to be all natural ingredients and I want them to be made natural, but I don't need every one of them coated in chocolate with every kind of added sugar that they can disguise as something else.
Yeah.
So recently there's been a scandal. Talk about the orange and brown scandal.
Well, so what's been happening is that for a long time, big chocolate makers, they've been trying to save money by replacing.
Oh, wait a second. I want to call them chocolate producers. You're a maker.
Yeah, correct.
Okay. You are a maker. They are factory producers.
Yeah, chocolate producers have been trying to cut down the cost of the ingredients that go into their products. And, you know, the cocoa bean is very expensive. Cocoa butter is expensive. Cocoa powder is expensive. So they found that they could take cocoa powder, which is the least expensive part, and replace cocoa butter with palm kernel oil.
Right.
Hydrogenated fats that are terrible for everybody.
Tallow.
Yeah.
Lard.
Yeah, Crisco.
Lard's probably too expensive.
Yeah, but it'd be delicious.
and replacing that and creating Something that's not chocolate.
All right. I have to say something here. And again, I don't mean this politically, although there are political ramifications. The bottom line is what's going on in the world right now has a lot to do with climate change, no matter what you say. You can deny it all you want, but it was predicted 20 years ago that as climate change went on, there would be more civil unrest because we would all be fighting more for resources. And the richest people are fighting the hardest because they have the most to lose and they have the most in their weaponry. But the fact of the matter is they are terrified. Yeah. And they should be, you know, because the world is changing as we're sitting here talking about chocolate. Yeah. And I think we have the better job.
Yeah. Safer.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, part of that is, you know, when you read the back of like a Reese's candy, you know, it's in like an encyclopedia of ingredients, right? I mean, it's all kinds of stuff. And most of it, you know, looks like it's from a chemistry lab versus a kitchen.
Yeah, you know, I used to have a rule at the Oakville Grocery when I was running it in San Francisco for a couple of years. And that was that you have to bring me all your products. I put it on the table at the side of my office, right? And on Thursday, I taste them. But the first thing I do is I read the labels. And if there's anything I can't pronounce or spell, I throw it away. That's it. Yeah. I just throw it away because there are plenty of things to make food into. I call all of that food-like product.
Yeah. Right.
Because and we're learning more and more every day that the ultra processing of all this has other dimensions. And there are things in there that they don't even have to say on the label that are dangerous for us and can't even be studied because we can't track them.
Yeah. So that's been happening for a while. And finally, I think it was just in the last week or two that the descendant of the founder of the Reese family.
The descendant of the founder of Reese's Pieces. I mean, come on, that's what I want.
Yeah.
I met a woman who is a James Beard award-winning wheat farmer. I like the way that's said. And she deserves it, by the way. But these juxtapositions tell a deeper story, right?
Yeah, so he came out criticizing the Reese's company or whoever makes them now.
Hershey.
To say like, hey, this isn't the same. This isn't what, you know, my great grandfather.
And actually, what he said was, I can taste the difference, and then I looked, and it's not the same.
Yeah.
And that's the thing about all this stuff. I think it was there was a natural, cereal, and somebody bought it and changed the ingredients. And the people who bought that cereal are the people who read the label.
Right.
Yeah. And young people, these are, we call these heritage candies, things that have been around a long, and when you see the package, you smile.
Yeah.
But if you eat them and they taste terrible, or if you find out that there's all kinds of bad stuff in them and you learn more and more about it, you're really damaging what used to be called a trusted brand.
Yeah.
Yeah. In reading these, we were looking at the back of the, or looking at the labels, and seeing that there is definitely a statement saying less than 2% of these products is chocolate. And one of them, the white peanut butter cups, has zero.
Well, because
cocoa
white chocolate
isn't
chocolate.
And this is not even a white product.
But it's also white chocolate, theoretically, is made with cocoa butter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is just Crisco.
You can clean your makeup off. Yeah. I mean, oh my goodness, right? All right, so the heck with them. So I'm not eating that stuff. The heck with it, okay? Maybe Milk Duds. No, I'm kidding. Yeah. What do you got in front of you?
So we've always been about real food, real product, our chocolate. So we wanted to create a chocolate peanut butter confection that had real chocolate in it, you know, real peanuts in it. So we created Breeka, which is our version of like a Butterfinger bar.
All right. So yeah, it really is wonderful. It's like a little chocolate pillow. Can you hear the saran that it's in? Yeah.
So that's cellulose.
Yeah, and this will decompose, right?
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah.
Possibly while I'm eating this?
If you can open it. So we make our own peanut butter for this, starting with peanuts and
talk amongst yourself.
Organic
hermetically
sugar.
Hermetically sealed.
Then create a flaky peanut butter candy and then cover it in our 73% deep dark chocolate.
Oh my gosh.
That is our signature chocolate. So
it's this little pillow that looks like actually on the side, it looks like a very small whale. and it looks like somebody made it. That's the thing I like about it is that it looks like somebody made it.
It's handmade. We're a small company. We don't have a ton of, you know, machinery.
Oh my God.
So we make our own peanut butter by, you know, using our stone grinders.
Yeah. And, And you know, this, unlike a Butterfinger candy bar, this is gluten-free and it's dairy-free.
And it's that way because it's supposed to be, folks. I mean, yeah. There are a lot of desserts in the world that didn't have to be made gluten-free. They just were for 300 years.
Yeah.
Because they're made out of almond flour or something else. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk about all the other things you do and what you're planning for Easter and Mother's Day and all the rest. Right back here at the table. So back at the table. I am so happy. I'm eating chocolate and peanut butter. They're called Bricca. They're from Volo Chocolate. It's peanut butter crunch covered in 63% deep, dark chocolate. Sonoma County Bean to Bar. This is, excuse me while I salivate. I mean, what I love about when chefs make food and not a research team or a marketing team or AI, is that it tastes like food. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there's salt in the peanut butter because peanut butter and peanuts should have salt.
We also have a pinch of sea salt in our chocolate.
Yeah.
Because it boosts the flavor, and salt also tames bitterness.
And it's also high protein. I mean, this is a high, I mean, now you're talking a protein bar.
Yeah, I think we should call this protein bars now.
I like that idea. Right.
High in protein, and also gluten-free, which is not something, there shouldn't be gluten in a peanut butter chocolate bar.
I mean, there's no reason.
I mean, you have to understand that gluten is not an ingredient. It's a molecular construct, and it exists in wheat and in other things. But the fact of the matter is that you don't add a little pinch of gluten. That's not what happens. It gives you a chewy flavor, a texture, and it can be helpful in certain things. I don't want gluten-free sourdough bread. I'm sorry. I've had it. It's just not cute. But it doesn't belong in here, and it never was in here. But sometimes wheat is added or flour of some sort.
It's a filler.
It's a filler.
Yeah.
All right, what's in the box?
Oh, so this is, you know, as we're...
Wait a second. Oh my gosh, that tastes good. I mean, there is something about when you eat really good food, and this is another thing I just want to say. People are going to say, well, you know, that's not inexpensive. First of all, drought and all the rest of that. But second of all, I don't need to eat 53 of these. I remember this. I had a friend who said, Snackwells, I could eat two bags. No, no, no. Yeah. That's not why. We make treats so that they are treats. And if they're real food and made properly from good ingredients, they're very satisfying.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So we're heading towards Easter, right? So this is our other, you know, chocolate holiday. From the beginning, we've actually done Volo Bunnies. And then this year, we're calling our chocolate Easter bunny a good bunny.
As opposed to the other.
I heard there was some controversy with another rabbit.
I think the label has to be entirely in Spanish.
Yeah. So it's a good bunny. And it's also, we just had the Winter Olympics. So there's going to be a tie-in between a major sporting event and a good bunny. I don't know if that's been done before.
Never. Not even
with
one
Easter
time.
Eggs.
Yeah. And apparently Lady Gaga's got a little song in the corner.
Yeah. and then we also, you know, we're going to have a couple other Easter gift packs. And so this box will have one of our Volo chocolate salted caramels, a pack of that.
So this is really wonderful. These little squares that are so magical and wonderful. I mean, it makes you want to go to a hotel to see if it's on the pillow.
So as a matter of fact, it's on the pillow at Montage, the Montage Resort in Healdsburg.
Yeah. All right, but talk about the difference between making... Because these are, and the caramels are, these are chocolates. They're not chocolate. They're made from your chocolate, but they're chocolates. Yeah. So you're becoming chocolatiers.
Yeah.
We refer to them as our confections.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. So, you know, part of, you know, talking about increasing prices, cacao prices are going crazy. So we need to find a way to create products that actually have less pure, I mean, we're only going to use pure chocolate. But,
right.
But, you know, solid chocolate things are really expensive, whereas if we can make a caramel, cover it in chocolate, or make our, you know, peanut butter crunch and cover it in our chocolate, we can make two amazing products and have them have our chocolate but not cost an arm and a leg.
And the food, it's still, it's food, it's not candy, and it's pure.
Yeah. So those are the things you're doing. And then you do the bars. Mm-hmm. And you do them in more than one size?
We mainly do one size bar. But like these little, we do have these little turn down, we call them TDs, single bite or two bite pieces. There's like a flat bar. But our main...
Two bite? Have we met?
our main business is our bar, which is a 2 ounce bar, and we have 9 varieties.
And what are those varieties?
So we have our deep dark, which is our darkest and purest chocolate, 73%. We've been using cacao from Guatemala.
Right.
We're going to actually making a change to use some cacao from Chiapas, Mexico, which brings us full circle to back where we started.
Wow.
And then on our deep dark, we have one with candied orange peel with our own oranges. This is like being the Sonoma County chef, right? We're harvesting our own products.
No. This is very, very important, and it's really wonderful because we want you to keep doing this. And the way to do it is to add other ingredients that are from across the street and around the corner.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So we're adding, we have Meyer lemon, candied Meyer lemon, extra virgin olive oil.
And where are the Meyer lemons from?
From our own backyard. We have
get rid of them, right?
Then we do our dark milk chocolate. Now, this is cacao from Haiti. It's different flavor profile than the Guatemalan cacao. It's not as fruity, not a little less acidic. That's our dark milk chocolate. Our dark milk chocolate has caramelized milk and brown butter.
Wow.
And then we also...
I explain to people when we're face-to-face with customers that this is... that we imagine this as a fine dessert to have after dinner, and we put the attention into it as though that's what it was.
Yeah, it's really important for people to remember. Look, prior to the pandemic, I think in some ways that was, and not just a time in history, but a time in climate. Americans thought they could have anything they wanted 7 days a week at a good price. And that's just not true for food. It never has been.
Yeah.
And as time goes along, we're going to have to refocus and really treasure what's absolutely good. And for all of us who live here or visit here, we have it here. So we need to share it thoughtfully and deliciously. We'll be right back here at the table. Still Clark Wolf, and I'm happily still with Susan and Jeff Mall. They have Volo Chocolate. We're going to see you at the Artisan Cheese Festival on the Marketplace on Sunday, March 22nd.
Correct.
At the fairgrounds, right? Go to I think it's CaliforniaArtisanCheeseGuild.com.
And tickets will sell out.
Yeah, they do.
So they do. Act quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I think most of the farm tours are already sold out. The panels are going to be sold out soon, and even the Marketplace does, and that's because... they limit the number of people who can come so that you can really have an experience. And if you come here, you could to the Marketplace. I'm actually hosting the Bubbles and Bites preview VIP ticket thing. So we come early in the morning, we get some bubbles, we get some bites, and we get to sneak in first. So there's only, I think, like 100 or 150. And then an hour later, it's open to the general public. And that is limited at the fairgrounds in Sonoma County to 1,500, which is really a great number. It's enough people to have a party, to have a really good time. How do we find Volo Chocolate?
So we're available online at volochocolate.com, but locally, all the Olivers, all 4 Olivers markets, Big John's supermarket in Healdsburg, Russian River Tea Company in Healdsburg. I mean, from Petaluma to
Andy's.
Andy's. We're at Andy's. Yeah. We're Sonoma Spice Queen in Petaluma.
Yeah,
I love that, Sonoma Spice Queen.
Yeah. So we're a lot of tasting rooms also.
And also some farmers markets still, and preferably in the cooler weather.
Yeah. Well, we do marketplace events, but not so much specifically farmers markets anymore.
Got it. Makes sense.
There's a big festival in San Francisco called the San Francisco Chocolate Salon that's coming up.
I've been there. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, it is so much fun.
It is really fun. And folks, I just have to tell you, and you guys should be proud, not all of it's good.
No, you guys
make wonderful food, but not all of it's good, because sometimes people just think that just the word chocolate is a justification for, spending and doing, and it's not.
Yeah. Yeah. So, we're found a lot of places.
And do you miss cooking?
We are cooking.
All right. Well, you're making... Well, all right, wait a second. We only have about a minute and a quarter left, but you are at this wonderful facility. Do you ever open it up for classes and tastings and teachings and whatever?
Not really. I mean, we focus on chocolate. We do offer... people ask for tours. Sometimes we do that. But you know what? Neither of us miss the restaurant business.
You've been there. Yeah. I know that one.
You know?
Yeah. I still have nightmares.
16 years. Susan had a restaurant nightmare this morning. So, but anyway, so we don't miss the restaurant
my gosh,
business.
You know, I did the other morning where I had this long thing that had to attach and it was a cord and I was in the walk-in and I could, I mean, yeah, folks, please be nice to your servers and chefs.
Yes.
It's a very challenging world and it's not getting easier, and it's not getting easier for chocolate makers either, but we're glad you're doing it. We're glad you're being innovative. And we're glad you're making such good food.
Thank you so
much. Thank you very much, Clark.
Thank you both for being here. We will see you at the California Artisan Cheese Festival on the 22nd. That's March 22nd at the fairgrounds. Go and be there and buy some chocolate. We'll see you next time at the table.
Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? You'd be in paradise and put up a fucking line.